podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are here with an author that I am a longtime fan of. He is formerly a senior writer for 538.com, often covering chess and other games. He holds a PhD in economics from the University of Texas at Austin with an emphasis on game theory. He was a 2020 Nieman Fellow, where he studied artificial intelligence at Harvard University. And he's out, I think it will be today when this podcast comes out, certainly in this general time frame, with a new book called Seven Games, A Human History. It covers the history and current competitive context of the games, checkers, backgammon, go, poker, Scrabble, bridge, and yes, chess. And it places a special emphasis on how AI is changing these games. And I greatly enjoyed this book, as I do all of our guests, chess writing in particular. So excited to welcome Oliver Rader to the show. Oliver, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and congrats on the new book. We're recording a couple weeks in advance, so probably the maelstrom of public talks and podcast interviews hasn't started yet. So I'm excited to get you first. And again, I always enjoy your writing, and the book is fantastic. So thanks. I'm glad you took the time to write it.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very pleased to kick off the maelstrom on the chess podcast. That's perfect.
Thanks. Yeah, glad to hear it. So I thought, obviously, we'll be getting into your relationship with chess, which, just as a longtime 538 reader, I've often wondered about just reading, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. But I thought it might be better, given that this is a book about seven different games, to talk sort of in a broader context about why people still play games, why there's a chess, why I'm able to do a chess podcast, you know, and, you know, 10,000 people or whatever listen every week. Like, why do these habits endure? And I enjoyed the quote that you had in the book that one of the reasons people enjoy games is the voluntary attempt to overcome necessary obstacles, from Bernard Suits. But I was curious how you contextualize the continued popularity of both chess, but also the other games you cover, and games more generally.
So I think games play a very interesting and very multifaceted role for us humans. I mean, the simplest reason that they endure is that they're fun. Archaeologists discover games from thousands and thousands of years ago. And, you know, a simple reason that we might have played games in ancient times is, well, there wasn't that much to do, right? We needed to pass the time. And the philologist Irving Finkel, who spent his career studying games, once told the New Yorker that there were long periods of time when there was bugger all to do in the ancient world. And this might be... This is, I think, maybe a sufficient explanation for why there were games. But I think the other sort of interesting theory about games' importance and games' persistence has to do with human agency, this idea that games are an art form, and specifically they're the art form that captures human agency, whereas painting captures the visual world and music captures the heard world. Games capture the world of sort of action and decision. And I think games are fun, but they're also practice, right? They're distilled sort of very small, crystallized models of aspects of the real world. And humans sort of crave this practice and this exercising of agency. And why chess in particular, and why the other games in the book in particular have survived, I think, is a question of sort of evolution, the sort of Darwinian sort of survival of the fittest. There's a bit in the book about, like, well, why is this statue in the Louvre, or why is that painting in the Met? It's, well, these are the works of art that survived. And, you know, chess and backgammon are thousands of years old, and these are the games that survived.
Yeah, and doing quite well in the case of chess, and some of the other games you mentioned. So you meant you go through your background with all of these games in the book. I'm curious in terms of the book's evolution, Oliver, like, did you know it was going to be those seven games right away, or how did you pick? Because there's so many games with long legacies, and you can't write about them all.
Yeah, that's a great question. It was not obvious from the beginning, what the games that I sort of go into in depth would be. There sort of a few criteria emerged. I wanted games that were well known, or at least fairly well known, games that had sort of active competitive scenes and active subcultures, and games that had been paid serious attention to by computer scientists, because I knew that I wanted to tell this sort of dual story, the importance of games to humans and human culture on the one hand, and the importance of games to the development of technology and specifically AI on the other hand, and this sort of intertwining story, because of course the development of technology is a human story too. We shouldn't forget that. And I'm not arguing by picking these seven games that these are the only ones that might meet those criteria, but they were ones that I thought obviously met the criteria and that I found to be compelling.
Yeah, I found them quite compelling myself. I have passing levels of familiarity. I mean, different levels of familiarity with all of the games. So I know you're quite a good Scrabble player. You obviously know your way around a chessboard from your writing on 538. Was there any game out of the seven that you felt like you were coming into relatively cold?
Yeah, there were a couple, to be honest. The two that I was probably least familiar with as a player were Backgammon and Bridge. And after reporting the chapter on Backgammon, I became a completely insatiable Backgammon addict. So I don't know why I hadn't played Backgammon before reporting the book, but I think it's an absolutely wonderful game. Bridge is tough. I think even Bridge's biggest fans will admit that the learning curve is extremely high for a variety of reasons. You can play something that looks like chess after sort of a few minutes of instruction. You can't play something that looks like Bridge after a few minutes of instruction. Plus, you need twice as many people and so on. So I grew up playing a lot of trick-taking card games, Euchre, Pinochle. But Bridge never happened to be among those in my circles. So I had to do a lot of learning about Bridge.
Yeah, Bridge was a game. I probably a lot of people listening might have similar stories with at least one of these games, but it was a game where I was taught it once and loved it, played it a few times. But I don't know whether it's a good thing or not, but my exposure was limited from that point. And I think there's a games players generally are attracted to multiple games. I mean, I certainly, like when I was reading about Go, Oliver, I was, and you know, I've seen the AlphaGo movie, but I've never played the game, but it just sounded so fascinating. What's your experience with Go?
I've played a lot of very, very terrible Go. That's my experience with it. I played a ton against my computer, of course. This is something I did with every game in the book as I write a lot about this sort of superhuman AI players, I wanted to know, like, what does it feel like to sort of play these superhuman players? So I played a lot against my computer, taught a few friends, had a few friends who were good players. So my experience is playing some of the worst Go that's ever been played by by humans. But it is, I think, a very unique experience at least in my own personal game playing experience. Just as I write about in the book, the rule, it's so incredibly simple in one sense, but so incredibly unbelievably complicated in another. And I found it sort of rewarding enough just to kind of get lost in that and have very little idea what I was doing, which I think is the sign of a good game. If you can be very bad at it and still enjoy it, I think that's a success of game design.
Yeah, I agree. And I wonder about that, because obviously here on Perpetual Chess, a common theme is everyone wants to get better, myself included. You know, there's seemingly infinite knowledge. I mean, and if you look at the gap, as you discuss in your book, of course, between the strongest computers and Magnus Carlsen, even that gap is immense. So there's just so much for us common folk to learn. So I'm curious, like, when you play these games, how you're able to balance sort of a drive to know more versus just enjoying them.
Yeah, for me, the game I'm best at in the book, for example, is Scrabble. And getting good at Scrabble is a sort of unique, I think, process. The most important thing, obviously, in getting good at Scrabble is learning the words that are in the Scrabble dictionary. But the words in the Scrabble dictionary isn't really a dictionary in the sense of, like, you use it to look stuff up or to learn about usage. The dictionary is essentially the rule book. And, you know, by training for Scrabble, you're learning all of Scrabble's rules, of which there are 150,000. And there's more to it than that, but, you know, learning the rules is the most important part of getting good at Scrabble, which is not true about chess, for example. And I found this process of learning the rules to be sort of a meditative process. And I think a lot of people might call it boring. That's another word for it. But yeah, I spent, I don't know, a few years in grad school learning Scrabble words.
Probably. So basically, you're just, when you say learn the rules, as you said, you're just meaning memorizing word lists, basically.
Yeah, that's right. And there's all kinds of ways to make this process more efficient, to sort of learn the words in the right order, based on sort of the probability that they will appear in a game and their usefulness if you know them versus if you don't know them, and so on. But yeah, essentially, digital flashcards of 100,000 words. So in grad school, what sort of motivated me to get good at Scrabble was that I had made a lot of friends in the Austin Scrabble Club and this very strong Scrabble scene in Texas. And, you know, essentially I was embarrassment avoidance. I wanted to be able to compete with these strong players. And once you do, as I'm sure a lot of listeners who are chess players can relate to, once you start to sort of see yourself improve, it's a positive feedback loop, and it can be really addicting. And once you see that you can get better, you want to get even better.
Yeah. And Oliver, I want to follow up a little on what you said about the different methods for learning, because here chess obviously is, especially in the wake of Queen's Gambit, it's kind of having a moment. It's gained a lot of popularity in the past 2 years or so. But there's also been an explosion in the learning tools. And obviously the AI perspective you write about, a lot of it is informed from sort of the top level of these games, like how much is it pushing the boundaries. But a lot of the learning tools, like, you know, sponsors of the pod, Chessable, which uses spaced repetition, which sounds like something similar to what you're talking about with the words list from Scrabble. And of course, there's all these drills that you can practice online and the tactics trainers. So basically, everything's being optimized and people are getting better at chess faster than ever before. So I'm curious if you could riff on A, Scrabble, but B, any of the other games you wrote about and sort of how the learning tools have developed with those games.
Yeah, I think that the phenomenon you're describing there in chess is universal, at least among the games I discuss in my book, this idea of sort of democratizing knowledge, for one thing, and increasing the speed of its dissemination. So, I mean, I think Scrabble is a great second example, which is, you know, if you started playing in the early days of the competitive Scrabble scene, say late 70s or 80s, I mean, how do you study words? You write them down after, like, looking through the dictionary, right? There's not yet any digitized word list. And sort of the strength of a Scrabble player was determined in large part by his or her willingness to do manual labor, copying words out of the dictionary. And nowadays, you're exactly right, this idea of sort of the Leitner card box system and how do I properly space, you know, a word that I didn't know a few days ago, the computer automatically shows it to me again. This idea of studying the words in the proper order, words you're likely to see given the distribution of the tiles in a Scrabble bag. you know, to take an extreme example, like the word pizzazz, P-I-Z-Z-A-Z-Z, you don't need to learn that word because you're literally never going to be able to play it in Scrabble. Yeah. It's a word, sure. But whereas, you know, aneroid is the most common seven-letter word that can emerge from the bag, and that's a word that you really ought to make sure that you know. And obviously the computer can sort of present this to you in that efficient order with very little work on its part. I think, you know, lots of games in the book have a very similar phenomenon. Another example is backgammon. So the way that strong backgammon players would get good in backgammon's heyday, which was the 70s, there was sort of this enormous backgammon boom, was doing something they called rollouts. So backgammon is a dice-based game where you move checkers around a track based on your roll of the dice. So players would sit down, roll the dice, move the checkers, put the position back, roll the dice again, and do this over and over and over to try to analyze the position, spending, you know, days maybe doing these manual rollouts. And now we still do rollouts. It's just the computer does them in milliseconds and thousands of times. So that's another example. And I think that the other interesting part of that question is sort of what happens to the games when getting good at them becomes easier. Not easy, of course, but easier. One example, I'll stick with backgammon. Backgammon used to be a gambling game, a hustler's game. You know, you go to a tournament and the real action is the side action, right? The gambling in the hotel bar or whatever. But the computer sort of erodes this part of the game, right? Because the computer tells you, as it does in chess, tells you pretty precisely how good or bad you are at the game. And in backgammon, before the computer, maybe you think, oh, I'm pretty good at this game. I'm gonna gamble on it. But now, at least speaking only for myself, the computer tells me, you're not that good at backgammon. And sort of, it sort of erodes this this delusion that maybe once flourished in games of chess. And I think this sort of second order impact of learning tools is really interesting and really diverse, has very diverse impacts across games.
Well said. Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, in one sense, it can make it more enjoyable in many cases. But I also found it interesting that you said that when you got good at Scrabble, in many ways, it ruined the game for you. And that's something I certainly would not say chess has been ruined for me, but I've said in the past, there is a purity when you're learning a game on your own that goes away when you discover, oh, you know, these are well-trodden paths and I know nothing. So, could you describe that experience in Scrabble a bit, Oliver?
Yeah. I mean, I can't play Scrabble with my friends or family anymore. It's not enjoyable for any party involved. The reason is fairly simple, is that just I am an idiot and spent thousands of hours studying obscure words, which, you know, then to the sort of seasoned Scrabble player becomes second nature and one doesn't think about it at all if you play the word, say, AA or AI or XU or any of these sort of Scrabble mainstays. But if I play them against, say, my mom is going to sort of recoil. And I think, I'm sure this is part of this, parts of this are true in chess, but in Scrabble, I think there's sort of, it's potent because most people think that they have a fairly good vocabulary, I think by default, right? You know, this is a language I've been speaking my entire life. Certainly, I know most of the words in this language, and I've never heard of that word that you just played in Scrabble. Therefore, something fishy is going on. But, you know, if as you get good at Scrabble, of course, you stop thinking about this and you realize that, in fact, there are just many, many, many words that are, for the most part, latent in dictionaries and very rarely used in the quote unquote real world. But I think that's one of the beautiful things about Scrabble is Stefan Fatsis, who wrote Word Freak, a great book about Scrabble, sort of talks about this idea that Scrabble unlocks these words that would otherwise never see the light of day. So yeah, it's on the one hand, getting good at a game is rewarding, but on the other hand, it sort of makes it difficult to play with other beginners.
Yeah, and for context, we should say, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're one of the top few hundred Scrabble players in North America, correct?
I think I haven't played a lot of tournaments, so technically my rating, I may be an inactive player. But yes, once upon a time, I was in the top 200 or so. But don't be too impressed by that. I don't know. That's damning with faint praise.
Maybe. I don't know about that. Because I get what you're saying. I mean, I think Scrabble, it's a certain subset of people that feel like they'll be good at it. But amongst those, they tend to be pretty cerebral types that would certainly be impressed with that. So I want to dig deeper on chess, Oliver. But first, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud, as always, to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Of course, Chessable is constantly dropping new courses. Some of their latest include Keep It Simple for Black by I.M. Christoph Selecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained. It gives an entire repertoire for Black no matter what you face, and Christoph is always thorough, yet not overloading you with variations. There is also a brand new Lifetime Repertoires Berlin Defense from former U.S. champion GM Sam Shanklin. I hate playing against the Berlin, so I'd rather you not get that one. But hey, if you're looking to learn it, of course, Sam Shanklin does not mess around with his course offerings. And of course, whatever you choose to study on Chessable, you can utilize their proprietary Move Trainer technology to help you remember the lines you learn. So be sure, as always, to go to Chessable.com and take a look at what's new. And we are back, and we're ready to dig into the chess section of the book, my favorite section, of course, although I have to admit, the book did make me want to be a Go player, so my wife's going to have to keep an eye on that. But Oliver, you give great historical perspective on chess, as well as sort of the modern AI landscape, but I thought maybe you could read a quote that you shared about, that I picked out about chess's enduring popularity. Are you ready to read that?
Yeah, happy to. The best theories place chess's origins in India around 1500 years ago, where it was called Chaturanga and had likely been invented as a miniaturized military exercise. The pieces, for example, comport with elements of the actual Indian army of the day, the all-important Raja or king, the chariot or modern-day rook, and the elephant, or modern-day bishop. While a debate continues to simmer over the game's precise genesis, some researchers contend that chess did not evolve from ancient games over decades and centuries, as many others had. Rather, it was invented at some single moment in time by some singular genius. Arguably, the really striking feature in the long development of chess is its subsequent triumph in the Darwinian competitive process, which has kept some games alive while driving others into disuse and even obliteration from the records, writes the historian Richard Eales. Chess was the fittest game, in other words, and it survived.
Yeah, I mean, again, of course I'm biased, but obviously that quote really resonated with me. And you might, Oliver, be able to give a less biased perspective. So what do you think it is about chess in particular, where it's taught in all these school programs, not to mention, you know, becoming viewed more and more on Twitch and has endured through these centuries?
I think the simple answer is replayability. I think the idea that there are maybe not literally countless, but effectively countless games of chess one could play. And, you know, I'm always struck by this when I cover the World Championship, sort of looking at the games that are played in the World Championship compared to the databases. And it doesn't always take that many moves to get out of the known database, right? 8 moves, 10 moves, sometimes, whatever it is. And I find that, like, absolutely flabbergasting that, you know, we've been playing chess and really good chess for quite a long time. So replayability, I think, is the simplest reason. I mean, that's why it, you know, grasps generation after generation. Another reason is I think the complexity is pitched to this like really remarkably well-tuned level, where on the one hand, chess is very accessible. You can teach it to school children. You can teach it to anyone, the basics, I mean. But you can sort of dive as deeply as you'd like into the game. And the idea of the complexity being sort of pitch perfect, I think, shows up when we look at computers and sort of how computers have grappled with the game, and that there was a moment in time, or maybe say roughly a decade in time, where humans and computers were basically the same strength. And by humans, I mean the top humans were basically the same strength at chess. And I find that to be pretty remarkable. I mean, you know, the famous Kasparov Deep Blue matches were very closely fought and so on. So this idea that, you know, one species and the machines that species creates were kind of fighting on level terms, I find interesting. And, you know, I'm not sure how much convincing your listeners really need about how great chess is. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. But I think those are the two things that come to mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. I agree. Our listeners probably don't need convincing, but they might need context because, you know, for someone like me, like I'm so deep in it that it's only something like reading your book that makes me think more broadly about, like, you know, I mean, I think in the case of checkers, it might be fairly obvious. I mean, you know, shout out to checkers, great game. But, you know, you can see why chess would be more popular now, but some of the other games, again, Go in particular, I read it and I thought, this seems amazing. Like, why isn't it more popular in the West?
Yeah, I think there's another probably valid but probably disappointing explanation, which is, like, let's say for the sake of argument that chess is the most popular game, at least in the West. I don't know that that's true. I'm not sure how you measure it, but just say, I mean, some game has to occupy that spot.
Right.
Right. And sort of back to the sort of evolutionary idea we were talking about, you know, some game has to occupy that spot. Chess is a pretty good game. It happened to.
Right.
I don't want to anger your listeners, Ben, but, you know, a part of it could have just been good luck.
Yeah. It's like the pushback against the great man theory of history. It's not so much that the game's amazing. It's just right place, right time.
That's right. Yeah, it was right place, right time, and good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and there are, again, I mean, I'm a former poker pro, so obviously I enjoyed the poker section as well. And there are many great games and different, you know, again, I think there's a lot of commonality in terms of the people drawn to them, but, you know, they check different boxes that make you decide, this is the one I'm going to spend countless hours on. Speaking of which, Oliver, I do think it would be helpful because, again, I've been reading you for years on 538, and I've always been impressed in your chess coverage of, you know, A, like the breadth of your knowledge, but B, how you're still able to present it to what's primarily going to be a non-chess audience. So I am curious about, I mean, I read it in the book, of course, but maybe you could tell our listeners about your own chess story briefly.
Sure. And thank you for saying that. Games were my family's love language growing up. I mean, games were basically all we did together. And chess was one of those, and my first memories in chess were playing against my grandfather, and he was a very strong player. At least he seemed like a very strong player to me when I was a kid. But more than that, my grandfather had a very strict policy of never letting kids win, which is a policy that, in retrospect, I agree with and understand why he held that policy. So my earliest memories are sort of beating my head against the wall, playing my grandpa over and over and over and losing. But then, of course, eventually I beat him, and it was a thrill. It was, you know, one of the maybe two highlights of my chess career. And I sort of went through, and I talk about this a little bit in the book. I sort of went through phases with chess when I was younger. The first was, most of the time I was happy to lose because there was just sort of so much to explore, so much that was sort of going on in the game. You know, what piece do I move first? You know, right from the beginning, there's this really interesting question that, you know, chess players are still grappling with in some ways. Like, and, you know, what's castling all about? Oh, now I finally understand. And sort of this sort of very messy sort of childlike exploration. And that was enough to sort of grip me for a few years. And then I became, you know, I was a very nerdish, bookish kid. And I became completely fascinated with chess books. And I was completely obsessed with like the modern opening theory, chess opening books, these like encyclopedic volumes that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. And I would read them and I wouldn't really have any idea sort of what they were talking about, like practically. And it's not as though like I remembered some deep variation and would play it, but I was so fascinated that someone had compiled this. So that those books were my favorite, like right alongside like the baseball encyclopedia that I would leaf through and say, like, I can't believe they have this guy's batting average from, you know, 1895 or whatever. And it, like I said, that didn't make me a good player at all. But the sort of second phase was just being fascinated by the sort of human compiled knowledge about this game. I was so thrilled that the world was a place where someone could put this together. And then the sort of third phase, which I would say that I'm still in, is as just a sort of appreciator of good play. Like, I'm never going to be a good player, a strong player, but I do think that I'm able to sort of appreciate what good players do and hopefully sort of give a flavor of that to a broad audience. You know, and I'm never going to be able to replace a sort of grandmaster's analysis of a game for people who really want to understand, you know, why Magnus made this move or Jan made that move or whatever in the World Championship. But I hope I can give a taste of why the game played at its highest levels is so interesting. And I'd like to think that this could bring some people into the game or back into the game. And you know, my favorite feedback that I get when I write about the World Championship is people saying like, oh, I started playing chess started playing chess again after reading your pieces about the World Championship. But to me, that's a huge success. So, I think I peaked in fourth grade when I won my elementary school championship, basically by memorizing the scholar's mate and hoping would fall into that. That's about the extent of my technical chess.
Yeah, the scholar's mate gave you some good runway in those days. It's a little bit harder.
You'd win like 60-65% of the time.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you're very modest about your chess skills, but again, in your writing, your knowledge of chess is quite evident. Do you mind saying for context what your sort of online rating is generally?
When I play online, I play very fast games. Why do I do this? Because I can sort of get over the previous blunders more quickly.
Right.
And to be honest, I don't know, 1600, something
okay,
like that.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, you're a solid player. I mean, and that's what I would have guessed. I mean, you're so, again, so modest about your writing, but your understanding of chess is clear in your writing. And I'm curious, Oliver, so writing about something like the World Championship, you're going to have, as you say, sort of casual chess fans and new chess fans reading, but you're also widely followed by like grandmasters and chess professionals. And I know that, you know, many appreciate the work you've mentioned that you help popularize chess. So I'm curious, when the World Championship chip or an event like that is taking place, what's your preferred method of consumption? Are you watching broadcasts? Do you have the engine running? Stuff like that.
Yeah, I try to throw the kitchen sink at it, basically. And I should say that the grandmasters who do follow me, I mean, I need to thank them too, because, you know, I try to reach out to strong players to kind of get their take on what's going on too. So I want to thank actually good chess players for agreeing to talk to me off the bat. So yeah, I live in New York City. And so when the match was in New York, of course, I was there every day. Just sort of getting the physical layout, setting the scene that way. But the last two have been abroad. So yeah, I have a couple monitors and I set up sort of everything I can. I have sort of the three of the sort of main broadcasts. I have the chess-based database that I sort of try to find the position in. I have the engine running. I can't deny that I have the engine running, and my story that, you know, these we try to write these as quickly as possible to keep them newsy. So it's really sort of a hectic time when the game is being played. But I try to take in as much as I can. Twitter, and there's a lot of really great chess. Oh, a lot of really terrible chess stuff too. But to be honest, a lot of really great chess folks on Twitter, which I'm sure your audience maybe follows or is themselves. But yeah, a sort of ecumenical, I don't know, a sort of a broad-based approach to consumption.
Yeah, and a serious pursuit of chess truth, which is appreciated. And Oliver, what about, I have two follow-ups. Number one, so did you expect Magnus to win? And I'm curious your sort of perspective on like the elite chess landscape now generally. How closely do you follow it in between world championships?
Yeah, this is a layman's view of things, but I found the World Championship fascinating, right? It was this tale of two cities kind of thing. I mean, we had some of the most accurate games ever played in a World Championship with, you know, these centi pawn losses, basically indistinguishable from zero kind of thing. And then we had the crazy game six. But then we had these sort of inexplicable blunders from Jan in the other games. And I haven't heard a sort of satisfying explanation for that. It might just be chess is really hard. That might be the sort of best explanation. But did I expect Magnus to win? That was your actual question. I mean, yeah, how could you not?
Yeah.
I mean, just given the empirical ranking system, which seems to be fairly good representation for the most part of strength. How could you not? I would have liked the match to have gone the distance, you know, if only for a sort of selfish reasons of I really like following it and writing about it. You know, I think Magnus's comments following the match that suggesting that he might not play. They might not defend his title are interesting. And I think, you know, we can talk more about that. I think, you know, and in some ways indirectly related to AI, right? I think, and as AI has sort of infiltrated the championship match format and a story that obviously your listeners are very familiar with, that the preparation idea. And I don't know, I don't like to sort of speak for these characters in my stories and what Magnus is actually thinking, but that he's, I don't know, bored by the championship sort of grind.
We will get back to our conversation with Oliver in a minute, but first we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Listeners, our friends at aimchess.com have a fun new feature that I want to tell you about. It is called the Aim Chess Recap. If you're familiar with Spotify Wrapped, it's basically the chess version of that, your chess year in review. They have a new design to make the user experience more fun, and they tell you all kinds of stats from your year, the ones you might be used to, like how you do with certain openings, certain colors, against who you played the most, how many minutes you played the total year, and then some fun stuff like the total amount of smothered mates you played, the number of en passants taken, all of your missed mate and ones. Okay, maybe that one's not as fun. And if you see something you want to share, you can easily share it on social media. So that's called the Aim Chess Recap. Link is in the show description. It's free to check out. And then if you do decide to subscribe to Aim Chess, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. All right, let's head back to Perpetual Chess. And to bring it back to Go, Oliver, because as you mentioned, Magnus may not defend his title, which, you know, as like you, I could sit here and armchair quarterback, but I don't know what purpose that really serves. We just kind of have to wait and see and hope that he plays. But, you know, we games give us agency, and he has more agency than anyone. So it'll ultimately be up to him. But I was curious, you mentioned sort of AI might have had an impact. And if correct me if I'm wrong, but Lee Sedol, the guy who, and I probably mispronounced his name, the guy who lost to AlphaGo, he was so, I guess, disheartened that he quit Elite Go after that. Is that right?
Yeah, he announced his retirement and basically told the Korean press that he realized that there was an entity that he couldn't beat, and that he was done playing the game, at least publicly and professionally, which I found fascinating, of course, and sad, of course. Yeah. And I think one thing, zooming out a little bit from Go, but I'll come back to it. One thing that's interesting about AI in games is just how disparate and just how diverse its impacts are across games and across individual players of games. And I'd like to think this holds some lessons for AI more generally, its disparate impacts in domains in the quote unquote real world. But for example, in chess, I don't think Magnus or any grandmaster cares that Stockfish is a lot better than him. You know, it's just sort of established fact and has been for what, 25 years. And you know, the traditional like way to think about it is like, you know, Usain Bolt or whatever doesn't care that like a race car is faster than he is, right? It's just kind of the state of the world. But you know, then you get cases like Lee Sedol, who this fact really sort of bothers, and sort of bothers to the extent of like not being interested in the game anymore. So yeah, again, I can't speak for Lee Sedol, but you know, there are many strong and many young Go players for whom this will just be the state of the world, who have grown up in the age of the superhuman computer. And, you know, I think one thing I try to stress in the book is that, yeah, these machines exist, but the human game is still very much accessible, right? Like, I played a lot of very terrible Go, and that's fine. Yeah. And, you know, I had a great time doing it. I played a lot of terrible backgammon. I played a lot of terrible poker, which was more expensive than playing a lot of terrible Go. But you know, this idea of striving, of sort of learning something from the beginning, of being a beginner in a game, regardless of the strength of the top humans or the top machines, I think is very, very important. And one of the most important things that games can offer us is this chance to sort of be beginners at something.
Yeah, well said. And just a quick point to highlight on the Lee Sedol matter. It's true that you say chess players aren't bothered, or they've been through the phases of grief, at least, about computers being better than them at chess. But I do think with Magnus, there's something about the memorization required that depresses a certain strain of player. Like when I interviewed a legendary Dutch grandmaster, Jan Timman, who of course played for the world championship and was a top five player in the world for decades. He said if he were coming up now, he wouldn't be a chess professional, because he looked at it as sort of like an art, a way to express himself creatively. Whereas now it's becoming more like a science. Is that something you're seeing across sort of the game landscape, Oliver?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and one I grapple with in the book. I don't know that I have a sort of ever came to a clean answer, but yeah, this idea of style, which you see in maybe every game, you certainly see it in chess, you see it in Scrabble. The style, by style, I mean, is this player aggressive and offensive, or cautious and defensive? And, you know, do they have tendencies? You see this in poker, of course, style. And this idea that perhaps the computer sort of dulls all of this style. Why? Well, because the computer shows you that X style or Y style is simply suboptimal. And, you know, maybe poker is a pretty stark example of this.
Yeah, yeah, that resonated in the book.
And this idea that, and this is oversimplifying it, but this is sort of the dynamic. Once upon a time, humans sort of learned the game themselves and developed what they thought was the best way for themselves to play, which was colored with their own human, whatever, tendencies. But now we all look to the same entity, the computer, capital C, and we try to mimic it, thereby sort of draining some like blood from the game. I think this is the concern, or this is a concern, and maybe your guest talking about that the sort of art had been sort of dulled in some way. What do I think about this? I think there's a lot to it. And I think that, well, how to put myself in Magnus's shoes, what does he want? He wants, roughly speaking, for us to play faster games so that we can become more human and do less memorization. And this way of like injecting more humanness into the game. I guess I think two things. One is that it's impressive to see humans play any game as optimally as they play games these days. To see these centipawn losses near zero, or error rates in backgammon near zero. To see humans playing games so well, regardless of the quote-unquote style that this exhibits, is impressive. That's thing one. Thing two, as I kind of mentioned before, it's okay to not play optimally, to play with your friends, to be what they call a striving player, to sort of develop your own style and to figure the game out for yourself, I think is a completely valid path of gameplay. And so I think that is still available to folks. The professional game, though, yeah, I certainly understand the frustration or the people being dissuaded. Like I sympathize with that sentiment.
And what's your semi outsider's perspective on these? Like on this podcast, there's sort of endless debates, and you mentioned in the book, you know, the possibility of something like Chess960/Fischer Random, or obviously Kramnik's been advocating for a chess game without castling. Like from your perspective, looking at the broad historical sweep and looking at these other games, do you think that chess needs to be changed in the near future?
I think one of the things that makes chess so sort of compelling and unique and sort of allows it to occupy this sort of cultural pinnacle as like the intellectual board game, quote unquote, is that it's been the same for so long. I think changing changing the underlying structure of the game with, yeah, Fisher Random or No Castles or whatever, some sort of very essential change to the structure of the game itself, seems to me, again, underlined as an outsider to be risky, because I think, you know, you also want to keep the chess economy and ecosystem healthy, which I think does involve engaging and bringing in eventually outsiders. And to me, that it just seems confusing, frankly. And, you know, we have this problem in Scrabble where there's all these different dictionaries that are used in by different associations. And the game, it would be similar to playing Chess 960 versus Chess to use one Scrabble dictionary and the other. And I think we've seen pretty starkly in that game that it's very unfriendly to beginners.
Yeah.
But I think there are much less violent ways to change chess. I think time control, and obviously this is done. There's the Rapid and Blitz World Championship and so on. But to me, that a change like, say, playing the World Championship at shorter time controls, again, as an outsider, as a fan, I would be very happy to see that.
Yeah.
I think it does introduce sort of just base amount of excitement, right? Like, what was the most exciting game in the World Championship? Game 6 by far. Why? Yeah. Because they were running out of time.
Exactly, yeah.
Like full stop. Like, of course, there was wonderful chess being played. There were, of course, whatever, 2, 3, 4 mistakes made before time control. But, like, other than that, like, wonderful chess, longest game in championship history and so on. But why was it exciting? Because they were running out of time, yeah. Right? Like, that's it. That's it. And I think, I don't know, you shouldn't ask me what I think the time control should be, but short seems fine, and you can play a bunch of games and whatever. But I don't know how useful my opining on this is, but I don't know how explicit Magnus has been when he's talking about this, but that seems to be what he's sort of advocated for, directly or indirectly. And to me, that seems very natural and relatable, right? Like, chess is essentially an esport now, right? On Twitch and YouTube and so on, and the big personalities are essentially esports personalities. And, you know, they're not streaming classical chess most of the time. They're streaming, you know, playing a bunch of rapid games or like the banter blitz type stuff. And, you know, if the World Championship sort of appeared in this format with which viewers were familiar, my sort of outsider's take is that that could make these sort of top level tournaments resonate in a lot more.
So obviously, no matter what chess, like elite chess format opinion is expressed, no one's going to agree 100%. But for the record, Oliver, I agree with you. Last chess question, and then I just have one or two others and we'll get you out of here, is do you have time for chess as sort of a dilettante? Like, are you watching YouTube instructional videos? Do you do puzzles? Like, or is it, you know, with all of your other professional responsibilities and stuff like that on the back burner?
I go through phases. I mean, I'm a serial obsessive, S-E-R-I-A-L, not C-E-R-E-A-L. Right. I'm a serial obsessive. I tend to cycle back and kind of go through very, very intense phases of chess. Study is not quite the right word. What I do is not quite study. But yeah, I think puzzles are great. There's the, you know, nowadays these like puzzle sort of games where you whip through them as fast as you can. I like that. But I tend to do that for, you know, a few minutes, think that I've improved, and then just hop on and play speed chess games. And my chess study is very haphazard. But I do. I think that a lot of the video content is pretty amazing. How people, and oftentimes young people, have sort of figured out a way to make this whatever, 2,000-year-old game compelling on the internet in 2022. I think all credit to them. And I tend to, when I'm into chess, be completely into chess, and when I'm not, not.
Yeah, I mean, you've got six other games to think about, so among your professional responsibilities. And Oliver, one question I'm sure listeners will be wondering, I probably could have asked your publisher, but do you know if this will be on audiobook?
It will be. There is a audiobook coming out the same day of publication, January 25th, narrated by a man called William Saris, who I don't know personally, but did a wonderful job. Available wherever audiobooks are available.
Excellent. Yeah. And again, strongly recommend the book for listeners. I enjoyed all seven sections, I have to say, as well as the epilogue. But, even if you just read the games that are your favorites, I think it's definitely worthwhile picking it up. Oliver, do you have anything to add before we let you go?
No, I mean, you could keep me for another few hours if you wanted. I don't know if you can sell that much ad space or anything, but I think one thing I hope that the book does, and that I think you do, Ben, and that is, I think games are serious things. And I don't mean somber things, but I think games are serious things that deserve to be taken seriously. And I think they're often given sort of short shrift in the press and sort of treated as sort of quirky sideshows. And I think game subcultures are some of the most interesting and rich subcultures out there. And I'm very happy and lucky to be able to write about them. And to whatever extent I can sort of proselytize for games in general and chess in particular, I feel very happy to do that.
Yeah, and we appreciate it in kind. And you mentioned in the epilogue, so when you're going to write about it, you say, like, if you go to 538, they just say, go for it. There's never any issue of, like, how many clicks it's getting or it being too narrow a subject or anything like that?
No, not at all. That was never an issue at 538. I mean, 538 is a wonderful place for a lot of reasons. And that's one of them. There was never any emphasis on clicks or anything like that. But even if there had been, it wouldn't have been a problem, because it turns out lots of people like to read about chess. And I think there is a wide open lane for writers and podcasters and so on who do good work on games. I think there's a very hungry, very hungry readership. So there was never any issue. In fact, they were very excited, and I was very excited when the World Championship rolls around every two or occasionally three years.
Great. And we know, Oliver, you're no longer full time at 538, but do you think you'll manage to cover future World Championships?
I certainly hope so.
If they happen.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of reasons why things might not happen these days. But yes, if the world champion, yeah, of course. I think and hope that 538 and other sort of general interest national outlets sort of open their pages a bit more to games. And I'm actually sort of cautiously optimistic that will happen. Because sort of the success we've seen in chess online. And, you know, if you look around, like, the ongoing Wordle phenomenon.
Oh, man, yeah.
Crossword puzzles are very, very cool things to do. Games are having a moment which has been ongoing for, I don't know, at least a decade, but I think accelerated by the pandemic. And, you know, I hesitate to call anything about the pandemic a silver lining, but I think games were an important sort of small dose of relief for folks. And, you know, you can see this empirically, chess.com memberships and stuff like that. But I think everyone can see it anecdotally. I mean, the amount of games that I was playing with my family, video and friends, with video chat to stay in touch with people. So I think maybe if we didn't know it already, we really realize sort of how important games are and can be. So I'm optimistic about chess for sure, but about games sort of broadly speaking.
Excellent. And Oliver, since you said there was more time, and I did realize I forgot a listener question. Can we dive into that?
Of course, please.
Excellent. So this is from Alex Friedman. Thank you for supporting the pod, Alex. And he says, some of the seven games like chess have complete information, while others involve things hidden or have luck involved. How do you think this affects our enjoyment and philosophical or psychological approach to the games?
That's a fantastic question, and one that's sort of a spine that runs through the book. These sort of basic characteristics of the game, of the games that I discuss, and the chapters are sort of ordered loosely with these characteristics in mind. Sort of as you go on through the book, roughly speaking, you add features. So checkers, chess, and go, these games of no chance, perfect information. Then the backgammon chapter adds randomness, and the poker chapter adds hidden information, and the bridge chapter adds additional players. So you have this idea of partnerships. So that was kind of the idea, rough idea of the organization of the book. I think in terms of appeal to players and philosophy, it's probably pretty idiosyncratic to the player. So I think backgammon, for example, a game I've only recently become very, very deeply obsessed with and in love with, I think has this wonderful mix of luck and skill. And why do I like this so much? I like this so much because I can play with anyone, right? I can play, and indeed have for money at odds, played with a rank beginner and lost. And yeah, of course, like right after the game, I'm not happy I lost to a rank beginner, but this is a crucial feature of backgammon that you can sort of get people to play because they have a chance. And I like that. I find it democratic in nice. A way. I'm sure that there are games players and perhaps chess players. There's a lot of great chess stroke backgammon players out there, I'm sure. But there's probably a lot for whom the dice do not appeal at all. So I think it's interesting. When you get to the top levels of games of chance. So a recent phenomenon, and philosophically, like, how do we determine who the best backgammon player is? Because there's so much chance. Well, you could just play a ton of games, and they do. But in high-level backgammon, a common feature now is let's have the computer look at the play in the championship match, assign it what in chess would be cent upon loss or whatever, in backgammon called error rate or performance rating. And not only do you have to win the backgammon game, but you have to be adjudged by the computer right. as having played better. So this is one way to sort of eliminate, strip out the randomness. And I guess in chess, the correlation between cent upon loss and winning the game is probably incredibly tight, I would think. But in backgammon, the correlation between making errors and winning is much looser, right? There's just a lot more noise. So I find that sort of philosophically interesting. But I don't think there's one set of features that makes a good game. I think that's pretty clear when you look at good games. They're very different from each other. But I do think this sort of one thing that's important in every good game is having some feeling that you're in control, even if there's randomness. So in backgammon, yeah, you have to roll the dice every turn, but you feel like you're in control. Scrabble, same thing. You have to draw tiles out of a bag, but you still feel like you're in control. You're exercising agency. You're doing you're doing something, and you're having an impact on the board.
Excellent. Well, speaking of doing something, Oliver, thank you for doing this podcast. We've kept you a little longer than planned, but it's been amazing. And again, the book is called Seven Games. Highly recommend it for all you games enthusiasts listening, which if you're not one, I don't know why you're still listening. So thank you, Oliver, and good luck with all the publication stuff. And we look forward, hopefully, to your continued world championship coverage of continued world championships.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, BennyFishel1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.